Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined by Frank Cogliano, who's on his North America tour. Where is the tour taking you this week, Frank?
I am in Eugene, Oregon today, David. Good morning to you. And I had never been to Eugene before. Arrived yesterday for a visit to the University of Oregon, and it is fabulous. I really, really like it.
The home of the
But heading to Port,
Ducks.
he, home of the Ducks and Phil Knight and Nike, who is, needless to say, in their bookstore, everything is all the apparel is Nike. It's a really, really interesting and nice place. We're going to Portland tonight, and then tomorrow, heading down to the Bay Area. And on Sunday, I'm flying back to Edinburgh, arriving on Monday morning, and I can't wait. I've got a suitcase full of dirty laundry to prove that I've been on the road.
So, I think it's germane to our topic today, which I'll reveal in a second, but could you remind people exactly what the purpose of your North America tour is?
Yes, the main purpose is it is to meet prospective students for the University of Edinburgh. So I'm out here with a group of colleagues from Edinburgh Global, which is our international office, and we are visiting 19 cities in 16 days and doing 20 events. We did two events last Saturday in New York. And what we're doing is we're doing information sessions for prospective students, particularly students who've applied and been admitted, and they're deciding whether to choose Edinburgh or not. And so it's a
Hopefully they
fairly
will.
lengthy, hopefully they will, but we provide them with a fairly lengthy information session that covers everything from the city of Edinburgh to academics and the structure of degrees and how teaching is delivered and things like that, to how you get your visa and get accommodation and everything. So it's kind of A to Z of everything related to it, that students need to know, or prospective students need to know if they're coming to Edinburgh. But we are seeing, I think it's about 1,200 prospective students and
Wow.
their families or significant others during this tour. So it's a pretty big undertaking that we do every year. When we started it 5 or 6, well, no, it was about 7 or 8 years ago now. I think we did 5 or 6 events in the first year, but it's just grown and grown and grown. And now it's a pretty massive undertaking that we do every year, but it seems to be useful. The applicants find it helpful, and it's useful to give people the information they need to make an informed decision.
Excellent. All right. So the way that relates to our topic today is one of the big news stories this week was the arrest of more than 50 people in a nationwide scheme to defraud university admissions processes. And I guess the big question everyone has, Frank, is are you bribable? And if so, what's your price?
No, of course not. And although I will, I'm gonna relay an anecdote now told to me by we'll just call this individual a friend who was working for a different Scottish university at the time. And this friend was approached by somebody at an event, doing a s event similar to the one we're doing at the moment, from the Trump Organization, regarding an application. And
Really?
the individual in question said, "How much?" And my friend said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "How much does it cost to get in?" Again, I
Ah.
want to stress this was not the University of Edinburgh. And my friend said, "Yeah, we don't do things that way."
Ah, yes.
And this person, said, "No, come on." And
Indeed.
so I think we don't do things that way kind of sums up the British attitude of when it comes to university admissions. And rightly so. I mean, one of the things that's quite striking to people on about our admissions process, and I know that's not the theme of this episode, but it does relate, is admissions for British universities, and you know this from having gone through it with your own kids, is pretty much based on academics and what you've done. And we can question the way the exams are given and the way students prepare for exams and everything else, but pretty much it's based on exam results and what you've done in school, and that's it. And the kind of extracurricular stuff that pertains in the United States just doesn't apply in Britain. And people here, when we're on the road, find that quite a relief, actually. They think it's much more straightforward.
Yeah, the two systems are quite different, and the British one is much more transparent about how it works. And it's much more centralized. I mean, you don't actually apply directly to the university. You apply through this consortium that actually processes all the applications, which makes it...
That's right. I mean, so in answer to your question of how much it would take to bribe me, bribing me wouldn't do you any good. Because I don't have any say about it. So it's interesting.
But it would do you a lot of good. It just wouldn't actually...
That's right. So Felicity Huffman, if you're listening, it wouldn't actually work. But it's interesting because at our events, we sometimes see parents kind of pushing their kids forward at the end of our events to talk to us. And they're clearly being told sometimes the kids have legitimate questions, and that's absolutely fine. Sometimes you can see the parents are calculating that you need to go talk to them so they know who you are. And again, because of the way our admissions works, it
makes no difference at all.
It doesn't make any difference at all. And I always feel sorry for those kids. But there we are.
So, for those people who didn't catch this news story, and there's lots of news going on with Brexit and many other things going on,
airplanes falling out of the sky.
Yes. The world is a busy place. The basic gist of the indictments, was that, a number of wealthy and connected parents arranged through a one might call a fixer to arrange to get their
People can be coached through academic admissions. University admissions.
Yeah. So and apparently there were two parts to the scheme. One was to fraudulently inflate their SAT scores. The SAT is a standardized test that some American students take to get into universities, by having somebody take the test for them, essentially, or to correct their answers. And there was ways in which they were using extended time to facilitate that. And the other sort of half of the scheme was to basically bribe athletic coaches in the United States to give students athletic scholarships, even if
not scholarships. That was admissions. What was interesting about it, but just to identify them.
Admissions.
Because the whole role of scholarships in athletic scholarships in American higher education is worthy of another pod. But they weren't giving away their scholarships, which is the ultimate currency that these coaches have, but merely saying that Susie is a rower week one around the team.
Yeah, there were some people who claimed to be rowers, or somebody who claimed to be a water polo player, somebody else who was a pole vaulter. They picked somebody for the sailing team. I don't know whether these are the coaches that are the most bribable, but they would, whoever this coach was, he would sort of serve as the middleman to go and bribe these athletic coaches to give these non-athletes, put them in the athlete category. And among the people who got caught up in this or arrested as part of this FBI sting were several Hollywood celebrities for trying to get their children into various places. The thing that the outrage this has caused is about sort of, how universities should admit students, the extent to which universities should be a meritocracy. Some people respond like, how is this different from legacy admissions, which has certain kinds of preferential treatment for some people? How is this different from making a large donation to a university? And we can talk about all that. Your man, Thomas Jefferson, he went to university, if I recall.
He went to William & Mary.
And what was the admissions procedure like for him?
He had to demonstrate a knowledge of Greek and Latin, and which he had. And being a member of the Virginia gentry, he went to William & Mary because he had that knowledge and he wanted to go.
Okay.
And that was about all it took. I mean, to a certain extent, he was, if you were a member of the elite in the 18th century and you wanted to go, you were able to go. There was nothing like the modern admissions procedure. I think it was just assumed you could go. I mean, interestingly, his contemporary friend and sometimes rival John Adams, of course, went to Harvard. And again, I mean, Adams was from a much more middling background, but Adams had to, again, demonstrate a knowledge of Greek and Latin in order to go, and was able to attend. I mean, interestingly, Harvard and Yale in the 18th century used to rank the class. You'd get a rank in class not according to your academic ability, but your social standing. Hmm. So there was very much a class element to it originally, and certainly that would be the case in the 19th century. But the modern system is a product of really the post-war expansion of higher education, I think, that made...
There's some stuff I think that's happening before that. But I think you're right that the 18th century and the 19th century, you go to university not to become wealthy or to move up in the world, but because you're already up in the world. You know, it's a signal of status rather than a means of attaining status.
Although I think one of the interesting things about this scandal that's unfolded over the past few days is the people involved are, you know, some prominent celebrities, and they've gotten most of the attention. But if you read the list, and I was looking at the list this morning in the New York Times, these are all very successful people and very wealthy people who are using their success and wealth to secure their children places at elite universities. But it's not as though those children won't have means. I mean, most of the individuals concerned, and you should think about the Hollywood types, have sort of, I would assume, have the kind of resources that ensure the well-being of their children and their children's children, and likely their children's children's children for the foreseeable future. So they don't need it to get ahead necessarily.
That's true. That's true. But in some ways, for certain people, it's still signifier of class and status as much as anything.
Right. That's right. That's right.
But I think you're right that, you know, from the 19th century and the 18th century, going to university is, for most of the people who attend, almost kind of window dressing. Maybe dismissing the academic significance of it too much. But you know, there are lots of people who went to university for a couple of years, didn't graduate necessarily because that wasn't as clear a distinction as it would become in the 20th century. And, you know, it was something you did in preparation for a political career, maybe a preparation for a legal career, but not necessarily a requirement for either of those things.
Yeah, I mean, my boy Jefferson didn't actually graduate from William & Mary because you didn't necessarily stay on to graduate. You just kind of went for as long as you felt like going. And then he went on and read law, you know, and had a bar, you know, passed the bar exam.
Yeah. And I think that was a fairly common sort of trajectory. Now, what would happen, Frank, do you think, if somebody went to William & Mary who was not of a... you know, Jefferson's class background, but showed up speaking Greek and Latin or knowing how to read Greek and Latin, but was from a poor family or disadvantaged family, would they let him in? They turn him away. What would happen in that case?
Well, they might have. I mean, the scenario you're proposing is fairly unusual.
Well, to be sure, I'm just
unlikely, but they did have bursaries for students of limited means or to assist students. So there were, in theory, students who didn't have that elite background could attend universities in the 18th century or colleges in the 18th century. The place where that is most common, interestingly, is this country we both live in now, with Scotland, where there's, you know, it becomes a kind of integral part of the national psyche about the sort of lad and latterly the lass o' parts, as they say, you know, of parts who has the ability and should be allowed to go to university. And so there was a tradition in Scotland in the 18th century of providing bursaries to students from more modest backgrounds that was pretty effective. But and that applies a little bit in the colonies. But again, the scenario you're describing is highly unlikely. The plowman who reads Greek.
Yes.
Although Jefferson kind of philosophized about those individuals.
Yes, but he just never actually met one because they didn't. Anyway.
yeah, they didn't exist.
So, I mean, one of the turning points, though, at least in the 19th century, I think there's some things that I think that are happening at the end of the 19th century that makes the university admissions process different. One, I think, is the introduction of or the revolution in university curriculums at the end of the 19th century and the founding of American universities on the German model, which are really designed around departments and majors and potentially graduate education. And there's a transition in which universities become much more about career preparation. You know, and alongside that, you have the growth of all the universities that are founded as a consequence of the Morrill Act, the Land Grant Act, all of those universities that are founded in the decades after the Civil War, but really sort of come to fruition in the 1890s, when you start to see a large number of students going to these universities that are career prep kinds of schools, where it is really seen as a you go to university to learn a set of skills and knowledge that you can then apply on the workplace.
I'm 5 minutes walk from the University of Oregon, which is one of those late 19th century public universities.
And you likewise have sort of a growth of a wave of private universities, so the University of Chicago, Stanford, those kinds of places, Duke University, that are all sort of established during this time period. And so there is a, you know, it's not the boom that happens in the Second World War, but there is a major growth in the size of when people are going to university. And so universities have to think about how are they going to process all of these students, and they start thinking about how do you evaluate students who are coming in? How do you pick students who are the right students to have to come to your university? And how do you establish sort of standards for, is it just reading Greek or Latin, or is it, a bigger set of skills? The other thing that's happening in the late 19th century is that university athletics is taking off, and schools start to think about admitting athletes in a separate category than the rest of the students. There's a period and point in which some universities are having people play in their teams that aren't even actually students. And it's this that leads to the formation of the NCAA in various stages by 1906, where they actually say that students, that people who play for university teams have to be students. But the supposition is you're going to let in people to be students who aren't necessarily of the same caliber intellectually or academic in terms of achievement to be on your football team or on your whatever.
Well, and the ideal for this is, because the cynics view is, this is just because they want a good football team. The more idealist approach is to say, well, one of the things that they're looking for is a kind of a class of students that represent society and represent have a broader range of interests. So you don't only want football players and athletes, but you also want cellists and actors and things like this. And so there's an emphasis on kind of getting a lot of different students from different backgrounds and bringing them together, because the ideal is that if you do so, they'll all improve each other.
That's the way they rationalize it. Yes.
Yes.
But it really is about having a better football team and letting in some people who are good football players to play in your football team. And the other thing I think that the sort of turning point is the introduction of the SAT, because I think that actually changes a great deal.
When is that introduced, David?
So the SAT, there's an interesting story behind the SAT. The SAT, there's some standardized tests before it, but the SAT, as we now know, it is introduced in 1926.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that early.
And the guy who invented it is a guy named Carl Brigham, who was a psychologist at Princeton and a eugenicist. And he built the SAT based on tests they'd given to soldiers in the First World War, where they were trying to evaluate, okay, who's a smart soldier, who's a less smart soldier, trying to measure the intelligence of soldiers so they can place them in various positions. And bring them like other eugenicists was or had sort of racialized ideas about who was, you know, on the top of the intellectual ladder in the way in which they sort of conceived of things. And the idea behind the SAT was he hoped it would help to sort, you know, the Anglo-Saxon people to the top, and so they can get into universities. So there's some very deeply racist ideas embedded within the SAT, and if you, you know, look at the long history of it, that seems not to have entirely disappeared over the course of the next, you know, close to a century. The ironic thing about the SAT, though, when they actually started to apply it in 1926, is that Brigham thought that the established American elite would score very highly on the SAT, and so it would sort of justify letting them into universities. What happened, in fact, was that many children of elite parents didn't do very well on this test, and lots of immigrant children did. In particular, lots of Jewish immigrants and children of Jewish immigrants and children of Catholic immigrants, of which there are large numbers in the
1920s.
And so one of the things, the outcomes of the introduction of the SAT is that universities start to have these legacy admission policies where they say, we're going to use the SAT and grades and other things to decide admissions. But if you are a descendant or a relative of somebody who has already gone to this university, we'll put you in a separate category and give you preferential treatment for admission into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, what have you. And people who have studied this have demonstrated that there's a huge amount of benefit that, you know, these applicants get as a consequence of being labeled as a legacy student. But that really grows up in response to the SAT, and they start doing things like having student interviewing potential students to see whether they'd be a good fit for Harvard, Yale, Princeton, take it, you know, whichever school you want to put it, being sort of the highly selective American universities. And embedded within those kinds of interviews and processes were kind of anti-immigrant sentiment and sort of nativist ideas about who belonged at Harvard and who didn't. But all those sort of emerge in the 1920s. Which, of course, is when the United States starts to put massive restrictions on immigration, in which there is a widespread nativist sentiment. So they all sort of fit into a piece there.
Right. And then you overlay that with the post-war education boom. Hmm. And suddenly tools like the SAT are necessary so that they can sort the far larger population of individuals who are trying to go to college.
Yeah.
It becomes a necessary tool, that along with, you know, prioritizing legacies and athletes and so on and so forth, as far more people in between 1945 and 1975, say, are accessing higher education in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's one of those factors, I think, are some of the things that make American higher education admissions very different than, say, British higher education. Lots of American schools have these legacy policies, although lots of schools are reconsidering them in the recent years because they're problematic on all kinds of levels. British schools don't have this as a policy. You know, if your father went to Oxford, it doesn't give you any advantage in getting into Oxford.
No, in fact, we now, in our effort to widen participation, which is a goal of many British universities, including the University of Edinburgh, we give slight preference to applicants who are the first in their families to go to college. So it's the opposite of a legacy admission.
Yes.
That's a relatively modern, that's a very modern development.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of ways in which people who are legacies have advantages in other ways, even if it's not explicitly in the admissions process.
Again, that was kind of the point. Again, one of the things that really struck me about this controversy or the scandal that's unfolded over the past few days is because these children are the children of very wealthy parents. They had lots of advantages, both in terms of where they went to school, the ability to have tutors, and I mean, there's a lot that can be done to game the system, as it were, without actually committing felonies. That you know, the system privileges people with people of privilege, unsurprisingly. So that's one of the things that was so kind of crazy about this to me.
Yeah, I agree. So I mean, let's imagine that one of these wealthy parents were to have given, you know, $1 million to these schools to fund something, fund a new, you know, I don't know, part of a library or a wing of something. That's perfectly legal as a kind of public, I don't want to say bribe, but that's really what it is.
No, no, no. It's philanthropy, David.
It's philanthropy, and we can think of there are some pretty well known people in Washington
I'm not even talking about that, because you're right. I mean, that's the more overt way to do it, and that's not actually that common, because it takes a lot to do that. Yeah. I'm talking about the advantage that upper middle class and wealthy people have in education accessing. All the, you know, so being able to build your CV and get the extracurriculars, able to go to Costa Rica and build a school so you can write an essay about that. I'm talking about the kind of institutional, the kind of inbuilt advantages that the children of privilege have in the United States in order to build their CVs to get into university. So I'm not talking about something quite as a building.
Yeah, okay, to be sure. But yeah, in terms of SAT prep, the SAT is supposed to be, you know, not teachable, but everyone knows that's a lie. You can prep for this and do a lot better if you have the right tutors, if you have somebody help you with the admissions process, that there's lots of, you know, there's a huge amount of way of gaming the system.
That's right, and that's what I'm talking about. And in fact, the guy who's at the center of – the guy who kind of turned state's evidence and is at the center of this scandal – was one of these coaches. So he presented himself as an educational consultant who would help you get, you know, would help you get into college. And there's a whole industry of folks who do this. So I'm talking about accessing people like that as an expression of privilege or consequence of privilege. And I think that is, you know, these kids would have had all those advantages anyway, and probably would have got into fairly decent schools as a consequence. Maybe not the ones they wanted to go to or their parents wanted them to go to.
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's a turning point with the SAT and with all that, the sort of ramifications thereof. The other big turning point for me in thinking about college admissions is in the 1970s. In the aftermath of the civil rights movement, the aftermath of school desegregation, figuring out how universities are going to factor in or not factor in race into admissions. And the sort of pivotal moment, at least one of the pivotal moments, I guess, is the Supreme Court decision in Regents of the University of California versus Bakke in 1978, in which the Supreme Court – are you familiar with this decision, Frank? This is the decision in which the Supreme Court said that
– Go ahead.
So this is the one in which the Supreme Court, in a split decision – the question was about admission to the University of California Medical School, and the two legal questions they were wrestling with was, can they use race as a factor in admissions, and can they have quotas? And four of the justices said, no, you can't use race as a decision factor in the decision, and no, you can't have quotas. Four of the justices said, yes, you can have race, and yes, you can have quotas. And one justice said, yes, you can use race as a factor, but no, you can't have quotas. And said that's sort of the legal situation that college admissions has been in really ever since, is yes, they can use race as a factor, but no, they can't have quotas in admissions for university, which has created a very interesting sort of sets of problems for university who are interested in creating greater racial diversity and greater diversity socioeconomically and otherwise. How do you do that without creating quotas? How do you factor in ideas about affirmative action? How do you factor in these things without also simultaneously not being unfair to other people? And there's been a number of court challenges, both in the 70s and more recently, to these ideas that either certain people are getting privilege they shouldn't get, or some people are getting discriminated against that shouldn't be. There was recently a case against Harvard where Harvard was sued by an organization representing Asian applicants to Asian American applicants to Harvard, claiming that they're being discriminated against. And so I think that's been one of the
because there were too many Asians, so allegedly too many Asians at Harvard, and they were too successful in getting in.
Well, actually, no. The suit was about people who were Asian students who were denied admission to Harvard because they said that Harvard was trying to cap the number of Asian students or something. That was the
argument. Right. That's what I meant. Sorry, but the admissions was basically holding their background against them.
Yes.
Because of the makeup of the student body.
Yes, exactly. And a number of different schools have had different sort of responses to how they deal with the Bakke decision and everything afterwards about how to think about creating, you know, a fair system given the long legacies of racism in the United States, of classism, of you know, discrimination of different kinds. And so I think, you know, part of the particular situation we're in right now in the United States with university admissions is, figuring out what's a system that makes sense both for individual schools and for a broader system, which is not so much of a system in the United States as it is in the UK.
Right. I mean, we have centralized admissions in the UK where there is a common application in the United States, but it's a way of sorting applications, really. I mean, each school does it itself. Mm. I mean, there's some interesting things. I was talking to a counselor at one of the schools we were at, so a college counselor who helps kids at the school this individual works at apply for university. And so the counselor came to our event, and I was chatting with them afterwards. And the counselor in question, you know, this was after this news broke, and the counselor in question, I asked them what they thought of this scandal, and they said they were not surprised at all, given both the pressure kids are under and the lengths parents will go to give what they perceive as their kids an edge. And he said, you know, the individual said, you know, once you factor in wealth, the kind of wealth the people who've been implicated in this case have, you know, there's no limit really to what some people might do. Again, this counselor said, not all parents are like this, not all kids are like this, but
there's enough
of really
them that are, yeah.
That there are enough. But it got me thinking. And so one of the things I've thought about, and this has been a theme in the podcast, I think from our very first episode, is the degree to which one of the questions that kind of overhangs this current moment in the United States is the degree to which we're in a kind of new gilded age. And by that, I'm talking about you've got extremes of wealth and poverty, but also the gilded age was characterized, and you see this in Mark Twain's novel that gave the age its name, by really unprecedented levels, to that point, levels of corruption, both institutionally and personally. And when you kind of package together, so Paul Manafort got sentenced this week, his sentence was added to yesterday, the kind of corruption and the allegations of corruption surrounding the Trump administration, and I'm not putting this college thing down to the Trump administration, but rather putting all this into the mix. It's like this seems to be a moment of rampant corruption, which is not unlike what we saw in the 1890s. What do you think of that?
So in some ways, this scandal also didn't surprise me because I've seen similar kinds of things going on with admissions, and with people of a certain class background for a very long time. So these kinds of, I wouldn't be surprised if these things were going on, you know, decades ago. Two, the things that were striking to me, one is that we're learning about these things in a way that we didn't know about them. So in some ways there's a muckraking, so going back to the Gilded Age, sort of a muckraking element to all this. We're learning about the kinds of, both the kind of corruption, and there's also a sense in which some of the people who are engaging in this behavior feel justified in what they're doing, in as much as they think everybody else is also engaging in corrupt activities, and therefore that makes it not corrupt. So I read some of the emails between the person who was sort of the center of this organization, that was this agency or whatever it was, that was engaging in the fraud to get the students in the university, and you know, the ways in which he was talking to the parents about this suggests that, you know, they felt it was justified because they figured everybody else was doing similar kinds of things, which very much reminds me of some of the Gilded Age rhetoric about graft, you know, where people like George Washington Plunkett, who was a Tammany Hall politico in the end of the 19th century, you know, he talks about dishonest graft. He says, well, everybody is doing this, and therefore, you know, if I'm making money through politics, then it's because everybody else is making money through politics, and I'm pretty, you know, straightforward about it. And there seems to be that sense of it as well. You know, that there are rules, but the rules are you know, meaningless, and we can sort of work around them. I think this scandal and some of the things coming out of Washington and other kinds of parts of the economy, I think suggests a similar kind of other parts of the U.S. I think we're seeing similar kinds of corruption being manifest that is quite troubling. Especially for people who are trying to play by the rules, right? You know, you can imagine this is where at the point in the year in which lots of people are getting letters from universities about admissions saying, hi, congratulations, you got in, or you know, we're sorry to disappoint you that we're not able to offer you admissions because we had so many great applicants this year. You know, dealing with both acceptance and rejection depends in part on you thinking, buying into the system that you were given a fair shot when you applied. You know, when people stop thinking that the system is fair, that then the system starts to fall apart, I think.
Yes, I mean, I think one thing to bear in mind is these are not victimless crimes, because
no, definitely not.
You know, the places that these children got by way, or these students got because of the advantages their parents got for them, bought for them, came at the expense of other applicants.
Yes,
and who, let's assume, were playing fair themselves. If they were cheating and didn't get in, well, they just didn't cheat very well. But the that's I think quite an important element to this, because there's a sense in which I think that some people might think, well, you know, they just did what they did for their kids, and they, you know, they went too far, but you know, they're misunderstood, and or they didn't quite understand the system. But I think it should be said, this is not a victimless crime.
Oh no, without a doubt. This, you know, most, you know, these schools reject far more students than they accept, and they reject lots of students who are deeply qualified to go to these schools, right? So anybody who's worked in admissions, you know, sees lots of applicants who are brilliant but can't accept them because they just don't have enough space.
That's right. One of the things the college counselor I was speaking to the other day said to me was that institutions in the U.S., of course, want to increase the number of applicants they get because it makes them appear to be more competitive. So they're perfectly happy to take weak applicants, or to encourage weak applications and spurious applications, because it shows that they're highly selective when they reject those applications. That's a slightly different wrinkle to this, but which is interesting. But anyway.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Frank. Go ahead.
No, good. Carry on.
Well, one of the things that's happened with university admissions in the United States especially over the past two decades, is increasingly the size of the wait lists have increased, the number of students who are waitlisted rather than outright denied has gone up. And one of the consequences of this is students are then applying for a lot more schools. And so the number of, how many schools did you apply for when you applied to college?
Oh, I can't remember. I would say probably 8 or 9, something like that.
Well, there
like
were
that.
Only 8 or 9 schools around the country then, Frank, so that's probably why.
Well, you know, I really wanted to study with this Plato guy, but he wouldn't take me in his cave.
Jefferson took your spot at William & Mary. But, you know, I think I applied for 8 or 9 as well, but the number of lots of students now are applying for 15 or 20, and that's leading to all kinds of you know,
oh, I think it's higher than that.
Really?
A different counselor told me on this trip about a student who'd applied to 29 schools.
Wow, that's a lot of application and a lot of money.
Yeah. The application fees are expensive.
Yes, which is also a difference between the U.S. and the U.K. Whereas I think in the UK there's one set fee to apply to 5 programs.
That's right.
And you can only apply to 5 programs. U.S. application fees can run into the, you know, $100 each, plus having test scores sent and other kinds of nonsense. It adds up pretty quickly. So it's not an inexpensive proposition. So we've talked some about this, sort of the bigger. If you're in charge of fixing this, Frank, what would you do?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I think a British-style system that places greater emphasis on academics and only academics is a pretty good idea. And I think, you know, I the British system under UCAS, as it's called, that common application that we have in the UK, is not perfect, to be sure, but I think it functions much better than the system in the United States. Having said that, the higher education sector is much bigger in the United States than it is in the UK. And as with many things in the United States, it's decentralized. So it would be very, very difficult to replicate the British system in the US. But I think a system that placed greater emphasis on academics and only academics would be a good idea. Having said that, we have to allow for the fact that academics and grades are not always the best measure for a student's potential, and so you do need some flexibility built into the system, and that's a challenge. I think one of the most horrendous aspects of this current scandal is the fact that the applicants in question abused the system of accommodations that are made for students, you know, with various learning disabilities and so on, and I think that's a particularly egregious dimension to all of this, because we do need to make accommodation for students from differing backgrounds of some kind. But I would want a system that emphasizes academic merit. But that you know, that sounds like I'm rooting for rainbows and motherhood, really. Which I am. I think rainbows and motherhood are very good things.
Sure.
What would you do?
Well, I mean, I think the I think creating more transparency in the admissions process would be helpful, and it's very problematic because, I mean, each of these schools has their own system, and each school is sort of a kingdom into itself, in a way that's very, very different from the way in which admissions works in the UK. And schools are very reluctant to reveal exactly what their processes are. You know, in the case that I've mentioned a few minutes ago, with Asian American applicants to Harvard, Harvard didn't want to sort of reveal what its internal mechanisms were, and only had to when they were sued in court and had to sort of expose some small bit of the sort of rubric they used to admit students. And so I think having systems of greater transparency would help, because often students don't know why they don't get admitted places, in a way that British students, I think, have a much greater understanding of who gets in and why they get in. To be sure, there's always a gray area here as well, but it is much more transparent in terms of admissions. The American emphasis, I think, on having sort of a well having a student who has a life beyond the classroom, I think has deep problems with it. You know, I went to a high school that very much tried to sort of prep kids for getting into fancy universities, and they were constantly telling us, "Look, you need to do well in classes and have great test scores, and be captain of the football team and sing in the choir and be head of four clubs and do all these other kinds of things," which puts an amazing amount of pressure on a young person to do a lot of stuff simply for the purpose of getting into university.
That's right. Yep.
And I feel like too much emphasis is placed on getting into university and not enough emphasis is placed on being successful when you get to university. As if the getting into the university is the important thing. I don't think that's, you know, the what's important is getting to university and then being successful when you're there. But this, I think the students aren't always set up well for that. But how to fix that in a system that's amazingly decentralized. Yeah, I think that's, you know, there are bigger problems to tackle in the United States at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're not going to solve this today, I suspect, yes. David.
Yes. Yes. Well, yeah. Luckily, they don't put us in charge of anything. So time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Right. I want to highlight we recently advertised a new postdoc in U.S. history at the University of Edinburgh, the Fennell postdoc in U.S. history. And I want to encourage our listeners, if they've received their PhD since 2017 in any field in U.S. history, to consider applying. Have a look at our website and you can find the details. But it's a 3-year postdoc. You'll join a great department and we'd love to have you. So it's the Fennell postdoc in U.S. history. So we're really, really pleased about that. And I think the closing date's coming up on April 11th, so you don't have much time. I mean,
yeah,
one of the differences.
Yeah, I'm going to pull up the ad now, and I'll put a link in the show notes. But it's a, you know, there's, so it's a postdoc that has some teaching, but it's a lot of time set aside for research. It pays, I think, competitively for these kinds of things. And it closes on the 11th of April. So it's a, like most British things, a pretty fast turnaround in that respect.
Yep. What's your last drop, David?
So on a minor historical note, I want to recommend the Captain Marvel movie, which came out, I guess, last week. It's a good flashback to the mid-1990s, which, you know, was an important time in my life. Really, I think, an exciting movie. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. I've been on the road for the past week and a half, so I haven't had time.
You don't have your priorities in the right order. You would have scheduled the trip differently around Marvel movie releases. No, but I think it was a really, it's probably not my favorite Marvel movie, but it's in the top third, which these movies are out there.
Yes, that's...
is actually is saying something. I thought it was quite well, and I'm really glad to see that it did well in the box office.
Excellent
stuff. Yes, good. And so you are going to be back here in Edinburgh before too long.
I will arrive in Edinburgh on Monday morning. I'll be back for about 8 days. So
we'll do some shows, we're actually in the same room again.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
All right. Cheers.
All right, David. Cheers. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.